Good day and welcome to today's conference call. Please note this call may be recorded. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Rand Beers. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. This is Rand Beers, President of the National Security Network, and thank you all very much for coming. We wanted today to talk about the current situation in Pakistan and what we believe are some interesting, perhaps even hopeful, developments there. But we want to speak about this in light of the fact that we are still deeply concerned about the security situation along the Pak-Afghan border. This was brought to everyone's attention this past week when the GAO published a report that reminded all of us that Al-Qaeda has been allowed to reconstitute along the Pak-Afghan border and is again capable of striking America, a situation that sounds quite similar to the strategic warning that the intelligence community issued during the summer of 2001. We also heard recently from Admiral McConnell, who is the Director of National Intelligence, making similar remarks about the wary situation along the border. Today we have two Pakistan experts that we brought together to both make some comments and to take questions. We will begin with Barnett Rubin, who is the Director of Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center for International Cooperation at NYU, along with a number of other important titles and activities and books that he has published. In addition, we have Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who is recently returned from the third of three trips that he has made there in the last 4 months. So I think we've got some good expert opinion here, and I'm going to turn it over to Barney first, and then we'll go to Brian. Barney?
Hi, thank you very much. I want to start by just talking a little bit about the structure of this border, because before I start talking about the tribal agencies, I think it's important to clarify what they are. This is a border that was that got its current structure really when the British were still in India, and they were defending India against Russia. First, you have the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is also called the Durand Line. It splits the tribes of the Pashtuns pretty much in half, although more of them are actually on the Pakistan side. I'm not saying that it should be moved, but that's a historical fact. And it has never been recognized. Since Pakistan became independent, Afghanistan has never officially recognized that as an interstate border, and governments have from time to time raised demands that either the tribal agencies or the Pashtuns in Pakistan be given the right of self-determination and choose their own state. Now, that's not an active demand at the moment. But the fact that Afghanistan, even under the Taliban, which was the most pro-Pakistani government that Afghanistan has had, even under the Taliban, did not formally recognize that border is something that Pakistan is very much aware of. Second is that it wasn't just a border dispute, but, of course, Afghanistan, since the independence of Pakistan, has tended to have a regional alignment more with India than with Pakistan. Again, this wasn't true during the period of the Taliban, and that is one but it is back. It is true again today. And just last week, the Afghan defense minister was not only in India, but in Kashmir, where the Indian Army is carrying out operations in territory that Pakistan claims is disputed. So that was quite a strong signal to Pakistan from Afghanistan and India. Now, across that border, however, is not an administered area of Pakistan, but there are seven tribal agencies between Afghanistan and the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. In these agencies, the Pakistan government's presence is not administrative. It doesn't have administrators, police, courts, and so on, and Pakistani law does not apply except in towns and along the roads. In those areas, the Pakistan government is represented by a political agent who runs the areas through a colonial ordinance from 1901, the Frontier Crimes Regulations Act, in which outlines how he is supposed to deal with the tribes whose tribal laws, as outlined in the FCR, is supposed to apply. Now, in other words, the tribal agencies are a kind of ungoverned or semi-governed space, not just because the government is de facto weak there, which is also true in other areas of Pakistan, like in parts of Balochistan and so on, but by law. In fact, the government does not extend itself into those areas, neither its law or its administration. Now, those areas were used by Pakistan and the United States and Saudi Arabia as a platform for covert, semi-covert action against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. They've been used since the 1940s by Pakistan as a base of recruitment for people to fight in Kashmir against India. And they were, of course, a major base for the Pakistan government's support for the Taliban. After 2001, when the al-Qaeda bases were destroyed in Afghanistan, the Taliban regime also destroyed, the main leadership of al-Qaeda actually fled into those tribal agencies. That is, when they escaped from Tora Bora, that's where they went. Now, of course, as we know now, intelligence seems to indicate that they have successfully reconstituted a kind of safe haven there. I would say it's probably not as extensive as what they have had in what they had in Afghanistan before, but nonetheless, the intelligence agencies are saying that they've reestablished a safe haven there. Now, the government of Pakistan, the United States doesn't treat the government of Pakistan, however, as harboring al-Qaeda, partly because the tribal agencies where they are not administratively under the direct administrative control of Pakistan, and the Pakistan government says that it has no control over those areas. However, since 2001, the U.S. government has pressured the government of Pakistan to undertake military operations against al-Qaeda and to some extent Taliban activities in those areas. However, undertaking such military operations in remote areas, where the targets are intermixed with the population, has created quite a few civilian casualties. And also, of course, the people there have, on the whole, welcomed those who are fleeing Afghanistan. At least they did so initially. Now, that doesn't mean they subscribe to their political agenda. Generally speaking, they don't. But bear in mind that this area receives virtually no services from the Pakistan government. It has a level of poverty and underdevelopment, which is not like the rest of Pakistan, which is a very poor country, but more similar to the rest of Afghanistan. And also, they don't receive any security. In addition, they're not allowed to have – they don't participate in Pakistan's democratic institutions even during the periods when those are functioning. They political parties are not allowed to act there. And over the past several decades, the investment by the U.S. and Pakistani and Saudi intelligence services in Islamic extremists as part of their covert action has really weakened the traditional tribal leadership in those areas and strengthened religious extremists without there being any counterweight in the form of other kinds of political leadership, though there are certainly strong indications that people there don't support that ideologically. Now, in those areas, a new group formed just formally in the past few months, but which was a result of developments since 2001, namely the Taliban movement of Pakistan, which is linked to but separate from the Afghan Taliban, which originally formed as sort of a hosting organization and defense organization for al-Qaeda. And they are charged with having carried out many terrorist activities in Pakistan itself, including the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, which they deny, but the government of Pakistan says they're responsible for it, and a number of other attacks on leading Pakistani figures. Now, in addition, you had the hot pursuit issue from Afghanistan in that as U.S. forces got more experience there, they began to realize that the bases for the people they were fighting were actually on the other side of the border inside Pakistan, largely in those tribal territories, and they wanted to be able to attack them or engage in hot pursuit. And just today there was an incident across the border where some Taliban or some kind of insurgents attacked an Afghan border post on the northern part of the border. The Afghans fired back, and then NATO helicopters crossed the border to attack the attackers and also gave covering fire to Afghan troops who went in again to go after the Taliban. And the Pakistani government has protested against this and said that it's the responsibility of Pakistan to undertake such actions. So that's become an irritant. In addition, of course, what politically in Pakistan, what the people saw was a very close relationship between a personal relationship between the Bush administration and President Musharraf at a time that he was suppressing the judicial system, overturning the rule of law, not allowing elections, and generally behaving in an increasingly arbitrary manner, and also conducting these military operations in the tribal areas in, without actually creating any base of political support for them. Musharraf never identified the Taliban as an enemy of Pakistan. He just said that in order to keep the United States from siding with India, it was necessary for Pakistan to take the side of the United States in this war. And that really was not sufficient to justify military actions against citizens of Pakistan in the views of many Pakistanis. Now, the parties that have come to power after the recent elections, which means, first of all, nationally, the Pakistan People's Party, but very importantly, in the northwestern frontier province, the Awami National Party, which is a Pashtun nationalist party, have opposed those military operations and said that they want to deal with the problem of militancy through negotiations. Now, there were some negotiations between President Musharraf and the militants in the area during the previous period, and the basic terms of them was we should leave each other alone and you have a free hand to go fight in Afghanistan. And those agreements really they led to an increase in attacks across the border in Afghanistan. But the main thing is there was nothing in those agreements for the local people living in the tribal territory. They were all about creating just a ceasefire so the government of Pakistan could maintain its contrary relations with the U.S. on the one hand and the militants that it was using for one purpose or another on the other. The current government, however, has a different political approach, and therefore when it engages in negotiations, I don't think they should be equated with those of the Musharraf government. The program of the current government is actually to abolish the frontier crimes regulations, bring the tribal agencies within the ambit of Pakistani legal system, gradually extend administration there, and thereby extend regular policing as well as service provision into those tribal agencies by integrating them with the Northwest Frontier Province. That is the program of the ANP, which currently controls the government in NWFP. Now, they have already reached some kind of a ceasefire agreement, it appears, with the militants. Just today, Baitullah Masood, the leader of the Taliban movement of Pakistan, who is in South Waziristan, apparently issued orders to everyone not to attack any Pakistan government targets. And they also had released one of the older leaders from SWAT in northern Pakistan, although a rather old one who may not have influence with the militants on the ground. But so far, there's no indication from that I have been able to find out of what other content there may be to these negotiations. I do personally know the ANP leadership very well. I know that they are very strongly supportive of the government in Afghanistan. In fact, the current leader of the ANP in Peshawar, Afrasiab Khattak, he's the provincial secretary of the party, was with me in Kabul when we had dinner with President Karzai on the first Afghan New Year's after the overthrow of the Taliban, and he's been back several times. I often see him there. He has very close relations with the Afghan government and is very committed to, and within Pakistan has spoken out against the Taliban and in favor of the Afghan government. So I don't believe they have any kind of, I know for a fact they do not have a pro-Taliban agenda, but in fact would actually like to stabilize Afghanistan as well. But they believe that the best way to do that is not through military operations in the tribal territories, which turn the tribes against them, but by launching a political and economic initiative to integrate those areas with the rest of Pakistan, in which case, if military action were required, it would be military action in support of the continued democratization of Pakistan and the granting of full citizenship to the people in those areas. So it would really provide much more of an incentive for the people of those areas to support the government than military action that is solely in defense of the U.S.'s war on terrorism. Now, we can see a few things happening just, and I'll end up with this, in the last day or so. As I said, there was the agreement with Sufi Muhammad, who is the leader of the Movement for Sharia Law and Malakand Division, which and also his son-in-law was leading the war in Swat, north of Peshawar, and he's agreed, in principle, only to use peaceful methods. Baitullah Masood has announced a ceasefire. Now, on the same day that Baitullah Masood announced the ceasefire, there was this incident I referred to earlier in Kunar, which involved both cross-border firing by Afghan troops and also incursion by NATO helicopters and some Afghan troops on the ground. I don't know if that's just a coincidence or if that was meant as a signal that you can negotiate with your militants about Pakistan if you want, but if we're attacked, then we will respond. I don't know. There are such incidents quite frequently. I don't know if they chose to make an issue out of this one because of that reason. However, I've had some discussions with people in Peshawar about these things just today, and what they said is that the government of Pakistan has some cross-border concerns of its own, mainly involving Afghan-Indian defense cooperation and the presence of Indians in Afghanistan right along the Afghan border, such as the consulate in Jalalabad and so on, and that before the military, at least in Pakistan, is willing to really rein in the Taliban, they will need some satisfaction on that. Now, there's a whole bunch of outstanding bilateral issues, as I mentioned, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But at least one small positive sign is that yesterday there was also a meeting in Islamabad about building a gas pipeline from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan into Pakistan and then on to India. And all four countries, including both Pakistan and India, participated in it. And as part of that, there was a very warm bilateral meeting between the Afghan foreign minister and the new Pakistani foreign minister, who's a member of the Pakistan People's Party. So it means there may be some basis for India-Pakistan confidence-building measures regarding Afghanistan, which would lower the Pakistan security border concerns on the border and make it more possible for the military to accept the ANP's policy of integrating those areas. So now, from the point of view of U.S. policy, the problem with if you've seen the GAO report, there's one table, one diagram that tells the whole tale. It shows how the distribution of expenditure by the U.S. in the Pakistan border region, which is 1% border police, 3% economic development, and 96% military. So the report is aptly called lack of a comprehensive strategy. And in particular, there was no political component of the strategy. And the people of Pakistan voted against that overly military policy that did not have a comprehensive strategy. But the current government in Pakistan is actually putting together that comprehensive strategy. And from the discussions that I've had with those people over many, many years during which they were out in the political wilderness, it indicates to me that their actual political goals are much closer to our interests than that of the military government that we had such a close relationship to. So I think we actually have partners for that comprehensive strategy that we did not have before, and we should show more confidence in them and support them.
Thank you, Barney. That's very, very complete. Let me turn now to Brian and for a few more comments, and then we'll go to questions. Brian?
Yeah, I'm just going to make a few comments, and these are largely based on my most recent trips. I was in Pakistan for most of December to conduct a pre-election assessment. I went for the elections again, and then I was just there once again last week to do a post-election set of interviews with the with many of the political leaders and the political leadership. And my top line is that there is a very narrow window of opportunity here to make the strategic shift in American policy towards Pakistan that many of us in the progressive national security community have been arguing for 3 or 4 years. The crux of a lot of the arguments that you hear coming from progressives since 2005, in essence, has been that we've diverted too much of our resources to Iraq and have not paid enough attention to events not only in Afghanistan but also in Pakistan. And I think the GAO report last week emphasizes and is yet another piece of analysis that highlights the missed opportunities inside of Pakistan over the last 6 or 7 years. So what we have now with this new government, I think we went into the elections, I went over as an observer, with very low expectations and some deep concerns about the election process, concerns about violence, concerns about massive rigging. And for the most part, though it was not completely nonviolent, dozens of people died in the exercise, it certainly wasn't as violent as some people feared. More importantly, this yielded a government, both at the national and provincial levels, governments, for the most part, that are viewed as legitimate, that this vote in February was an expression of the will of the people, and I agree with much of what Dr. Rubin said in terms of this new government being able to express the will of the people and constructing a new strategy, because I think there's a deep understanding of the multiple challenges they face. Here I'd highlight three. One, the political tensions that continue to exist, many of the unanswered questions of whether the orders instituted by President Musharraf under emergency rule will be fully rescinded, whether the judicial independence will be achieved at some point. And I think these remain largely unanswered questions, but I think the parties in the national government have moved pretty rapidly to address them. Second are the security dynamics, and here I think Dr. Rubin covered it pretty comprehensively, but there are, as everyone notes, deals being struck, negotiations between different actors in these new government authorities with local Taliban. And I think we can talk a little bit about that. Here I'm hopeful but also a little cautious and skeptical about the prospects for moving forward. And then one final note, on my last trip, just returning last week, very deep concerns about the economic dire straits that the country is in. The food price crisis washing over the country. We experienced rolling blackouts in Multan, which actually led to some violence. So this government has a pretty full plate, and I think it requires the current U.S. administration to shift its approach. I'm cautious but not all that hopeful that we'll see major shifts because I don't think we've seen a comprehensive plan coming from the U.S. government that adapts to these new realities. One point I'd like to make about General Petraeus and his appointment as the head of CENTCOM. This has been in the news today and was announced yesterday. I think this is an important opportunity for General Petraeus to change and evolve his views. His field of vision has been narrowly focused on the conflict in Iraq, and now his once he assumes this new position, and I'm assuming he will without much difficulty, he will have an area of responsibility that stretches all the way from the Horn of Africa and Egypt in the West to Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it is my hope that he will, like many others in the military and many other professionals in the intelligence and diplomatic services, highlight the need to make a shift from a policy that is heavily Iraq-centric and one that is much more nuanced and pays more attention to what's happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm a bit skeptical given the Bush administration's approach even after these elections, sending John Negroponte and Richard Boucher even before the formation of this coalition government, I think was a bad move and was not received well in the Pakistani government. We need, I think, a different approach, one that gives enough space to the new governing authorities in Pakistan, one that is less focused on Musharraf. And I think this was still a broadly held perception on this last trip, that the U.S. is still intent on keeping its close ties to one singular individual, and I think we need to move beyond that and change those perceptions in Pakistan to get to a better national security approach.
Thank you, Brian. We'll go to questions now.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. To remove your question, please press the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one, and we'll take a moment for questions to queue. At this time, we have no questions. We do have a question from Subrata Chakravi. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a question for either of you. There is some indication that if the Chief Justice is reinstated as the government wishes, they might well then turn on President Musharraf with indictments. Given the United States' unstinting support for General Musharraf, what do you think would be the U.S. government's response? Such indictments occurred.
Well, this is Barney Rubin. I don't think it's a question of indictments. I think what they're concerned about, initially at least, is that they will issue a finding that his election violated the Constitution of Pakistan and therefore is invalid, and that it's necessary to hold a new presidential election. And at this point, I find it hard to imagine that the United States would intervene to try to stop the government from enforcing a decision of the Supreme Court, much as they might like to. Perhaps they would engage in some kind of maneuvers to support Musharraf running now that he is a civilian, because the constitutional point in question is the illegality of a sitting military officer running for president of the country. So he's now a civilian, so conceivably he could do that again. They might try to support him, but I think that would be the kiss of death for him, actually, if they did that, because you know, he's been seen very much as an American puppet. So if they do that, I think they will have very little choice but to let the Pakistani legal and political system take its course.
I agree. This is Brian Katsoulis. I would say from my interviews last week, I detected, first, you know, President Musharraf remains deeply unpopular. His political movement, if it even existed, the PMLQ, was decimated in these last elections. Deeply unpopular. But I did detect among some of the political winners in this election, particularly among some in the PPP, perhaps a softening of their opposition, a gentle softening of their opposition to Musharraf, a little bit more talk of stripping him of his powers or stripping the presidency of many of these powers, but perhaps working around him. I don't know whether that would actually be something that is acceptable to the PML Noon as a final consequence, but I think this 2008, this year, we will see a continuation of the struggle between the different branches of government. The very checks and balances are still up for grabs between the judicial, the legislative, and executive authorities. And whether Musharraf goes or not, I think, is still one of the big looming questions. And what I heard in this last trip was much more discussion of, well, we may not want to push it for a number of reasons. Him completely out of power, we may just try to strip the office of the presidency of power.
If I may just clarify, there actually is an additional branch of government in Pakistan, which is called the military. And the military has operated basically as the dominant party that controls the other branches. In fact, that was clearly President Musharraf's idea of how the three branches of government should work together was much closer to the military idea of jointness than to the constitutional idea of separation of powers. And he was outraged when the judicial branch went off on its own and you know, challenged the executive branch. The way the Constitution of Pakistan is set up is that the president is there as the vehicle for putting a military check on a civilian prime minister. That is how it is structured. And that is the reason that the president has either been a former military or a former high bureaucrat. So that actually by reducing the power of the president relative to the prime minister, the government would also be reducing the ability of the military to intervene in Pakistani politics. And the position that the military would take on that would be key to the outcome.
If I may just follow up on that, what is the likelihood that the military would stand by and let the presidency be gutted? And secondly, what about the fifth branch of government, the inter-service intelligence?
Well, the ISI actually is part of the military. I don't believe it is an independent agency operating by itself. It's not like the CIA or any of the intelligence agencies in the United States. It is under the control of the Chief of Army Staff and answers to him. What the military will do, I don't know, but what I did detect when I was there is that there is some thinking in the officer corps that the military has been damaged in its ability to carry out its basic national defense mission. And the Pakistan military, you know, unlike the military in, say, Nigeria or Argentina or a number of other countries that have had military governments, the Pakistan military does see itself as having a genuine national defense mission with respect to India. The current Chief of Army Staff, General Kayani, in fact, ordered the removal of military officers from the civilian offices a week or so before the elections, which may be one reason that there was no poll day rigging of the elections. So he may be espousing an agenda of greater professionalization of the military. He's also facing a political problem in that the military used to be, according to public opinion polls, the institution in Pakistan in which people felt the most confidence. And that has radically changed since Musharraf's dismissal of the judges. The popularity of the military has reached an all-time low, and I think that it's a great concern of the officer corps that that affects morale, and they would like to restore their popularity, and getting out of politics to some extent is necessary to do that.
Can we go to more questions now?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one. We'll now go to Kate Moody of Feature Story News. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, I wanted to ask about the aid package that's being debated in the U.S. Congress at the moment, sponsored by Joe Biden, I think. What do you know any specifics about that, and how will the money be used if it does pass?
I don't know, Brian, have you looked at that?
I've looked at it in very general terms and talked to Biden's staff about it. I mean, first, I must say I think that they're offering this up at a moment where they may be skeptical that this administration, the Bush administration, is in a position to take on such a large shift and change in policy. Much of it centers around offering unconditional economic assistance, boosting support to the Pakistani government during this moment, as I was talking about, of crisis that they're facing. And I think a lot of the challenges that they face with the food prices, this is a problem not only in Pakistan but around the world, the challenge of poverty and even the gains that were made in poverty reduction may be washed away by some of these very basic challenges for people being able to eat and get food. So there's a great deal, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but a major plus up in the amount of money that we would deliver bilaterally. And this builds upon, I think, some shifts that were made in the assistance package last year by both the Bush administration and by Congress to try to put a little bit more accountability and a little bit more focus on money that used to go directly as budget support to the Pakistani government and trying to put more in the hands of the Pakistani people. I think there are a lot of questions about both this new aid package from the Bush administration and then also what Senator Biden is proposing in terms of how this can be implemented and how quickly and rapidly this could get to the people. And I think there's some questions here in Washington of whether or not they're going to get enough support, because much of the debate, unfortunately, still is centered on Iraq and somewhat on Afghanistan. And I think there's some really good ideas tied to these, including the Reconstruction Opportunity Zones. But I think inside the Beltway, there's some questions about whether or not this will actually gain steam, because I think these elections were perceived to have gone well, and the country perhaps is not so much in a crisis. And I'm afraid it may slip off the radar screen just as it had, you know, in 2004 and 2005.
Although, this is Rand Beers, I think there is a possibility that it may be attached to the Iraq-Afghanistan supplemental in order to force a vote on it.
What I understood, the main concept of it was to double the total aid package and make almost all the additional aid go into the civilian side in order to create a democracy dividend for
right.
Pakistan.
Right. Yes.
And that I think the political message that our previous aid has given is that we are providing aid to the military of Pakistan. And actually, that budget support didn't go to the general budget of the Pakistan government. It was specifically to reimburse the military for its alleged operational expenses in support of U.S. objectives in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So it was seen very much as symbolizing a partnership between the United States and solely the military, or even General Musharraf, in order to carry out our objectives, and not as a sign of a partnership between the United States and Pakistan as a whole. And I think the overall political objective is to make the aid package symbolize that new kind of relationship.
Can we go to more questions now?
Certainly. We'll go to Spencer Ackerman. Please go ahead, sir.
Just answered. But, Brian, I was wondering if you could give a little bit more detail on what, if we have this limited window to reorient our stance on Pakistan, the consequences of having the window closed.
Well, I think the consequences are cataclysmic. I mean, this is, as Rand mentioned at the top of the call, if we maintain a posture, which I largely interpret still very much Musharraf-centric, I think we're certain parts of our government are trying to adapt and change, and we've certainly reached out even before these elections to Kayani. But I think the potential for us misfiring has a tremendous blowback. I mean, I heard a lot in my interviews concerns about, and Dr. Rubin mentioned this, about if there were more unilateral military strikes by the U.S. at this point, this could further destabilize the situation when this new government is just trying to get its legs and send out feelers and try to perhaps split off some of the more extremist elements from the local Taliban and work more with the tribal elements. And, you know, I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories in Pakistan, and some of them are grounded in some reality, some of it not. But heard a lot about just when there were about to be a deal that the U.S. would unilaterally strike against these forces. And these are the perceptions out there, and I think we have an opening here with the possibility of the types of packages that Senator Biden has offered to change that and change that reality. If we don't, this is where the central front in the war on terror, if there is one, is. It's along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. It is not in Iraq. And I think the dangers of mishandling this are tremendous, especially as the DNI and our intelligence agencies are telling us that if there's another 9/11 type attack, it's likely to emerge from people trained in the border regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Can we go to another question now?
Once again, if you do have a question, please press the star and one. We'll now go to Josh Meyer of the LA Times. Please go ahead, sir.
Whoever wants to answer it. You and everybody else have expressed sort of deep skepticism, it seems, about these new peace talks and the negotiations and so on. But can you go into your thoughts about that a little more? Is there any possibility that any of these various efforts are legitimate and that they might produce a good result, certainly better than some results we've seen in the past?
Well, I did not intend to express deep skepticism about them. I expressed deep skepticism about President Musharraf's negotiations with the militants.
Right.
I am relatively hopeful about the current government's negotiations because there are negotiations about a different subject. That is, the strategic and political objective of the current government in the border regions is different from the military's. Of course, they also want to have a ceasefire, but they want to have a ceasefire in order to incorporate those areas into the mainstream of Pakistan. And bear in mind, and the special status of the tribal areas has been essential to their use over the years as a staging area for covert action by Pakistan's intelligence agencies, particularly the ISI, because they're closed to the outside world. The regular law legal system does not operate there. They're closed to examination by journalists and so on. If they are opened up, and also there's no political counterweight to whatever militant groups the military may decide to fund and support there. If they extend the political parties law there, allow the people there to have elected administrations, open it to the press and the outside world, then it will no longer be so easy to hide militant camps, madrasas that are being used as training centers and so on, in addition to which the local people would see that a real advantage in terms of their getting citizenship rights, public services, and the start of development. And if Al-Qaeda, who are a bunch of foreigners after all, stood against that because it's clearly not in their interest, then the local people have much more of an incentive to align with the government than they would have under Musharraf's regime. Now, the problem is that it's a longer-term policy, and there is a period during which the ceasefire during which the political negotiations will take place might in fact give militants a freer hand. Mm-hmm. Right now, even before these ceasefires, I might add, we have already seen an increase in the tempo of Taliban military operations this year as compared to last year, and we can expect that to increase. Now, that was happening already before any of these deals took place, But as it continues, I imagine there will be some attempts to attribute it to these deals, which I'm not sure will be accurate. But in any case, that will provide an occasion when there will be pressure to undertake actions that could make it harder for the government of Pakistan to carry out its political absorption policy, which in the long run is very much in the interests of the United States. After all, our national security doctrine says that ungoverned areas are a major source of threat. And what they are actually trying to do is extend governance into those areas, which is just what we would want.
Yeah.
Josh, do you want to continue?
Just to follow up on that, Barney, you said that you personally know the ANP leaders very well, and I know that they're at least somewhat involved in this. But who are the people that they're trying to that are the negotiating parties on the other side here? I mean, are they, besides Massoud, is it like the various tribal elders, or do you got anybody who wants knows any details? Do we know who we're talking about here?
I don't know the details yet. I will be there in mid-May and as their guest, and when I come back, I can tell you.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is Brian. In my discussions with the ANP in Peshawar last week, just very briefly, they were talking to the Massouds and the different tribal. They emphasized that their approach was different from what Musharraf tried to do in 2006, I believe it was, in Waziristan, that they were trying to have greater reach and depth within the tribal elements there. And it seemed to me that not only in Peshawar and Islamabad, that there was, if not stated, a goal to try to get some things done on this front in a shorter period of time than Musharraf was able to do, you know, to deliver in, say, 6-7 months, a year, some tangible outcomes, perhaps not a deal, but get something done and prove, you know, to a whole host of actors that they could do more than Musharraf could in the 8 or 9 years, that those political imperatives, I think, were pretty strong there.
Right.
Next question, please.
We'll now go to Jim Loeb of the Interpress Service. Please go ahead, sir.
I had two questions. One, could you go into any more detail about what your perceptions have been of the evolution of U.S. policy, if any, that is the administration's policy, and the Pentagon's policy in particular, since the elections? Has there been any change? What was General Fallon doing? He was traveling there frequently. Was it all Musharraf, or did you see any hopeful signs of involving the elected government? The second question I had, if I may, was the nature of the leadership in the tribal areas. I've gone to a couple of briefings which over the past year or so, which basically have stressed that the traditional tribal leadership had really been, for all practical purposes, wiped out by the more ideological Taliban elements, and that it would be that in some ways it might be too late to try to revive that leadership because the of the way that the ideological leadership like Massoud had had become so dominant. And I'd like to get your impressions about that.
Well, on U.S. policy, I have the impression that the quite harsh reception that Negroponte and Boucher received was a bit of a wake-up call. But I don't have any first-hand information, but from what I see in the press, they've decided not to undertake major operations, cross-border operations, during the period when the government is trying to put together its policy. I know I was involved in some discussions. There were some people in the administration who thought that it would be a good idea to take advantage of this period where Pakistan didn't have a well-formed government or a coherent policy to try to undertake a lot more operations. But I think the conclusion that they reached was, if you can do one such operation, but that will be your last. And they don't have the kind of intelligence to which would make one operation very useful. So I think they have decided that for now they're going to see what happens with this administration. And I should add, of course, everyone knows that there will be a new administration in the United States as well, and they're planning things around that. Yeah. And the leadership question, that is the way that the military government of Pakistan depicted it, in particular to Americans, as if there are two possibilities, the traditional tribal leadership and the militants, and since the tribal leadership is weaker, therefore we have to deal with the militants. However, the position of the ANP, I think have even better knowledge of the tribal areas, is that they agree, in fact, and it is true, that the tribal leadership has been decimated. It's been decimated partly because of support originally by the U.S. and then by the Pakistan military for the militants, and also because there is no government presence in the tribal areas to provide security, and in fact, tribal elders who opposed the militants were assassinated. Several hundred of them have been assassinated. That's not a naturally occurring social process. That's the result of the lack of security. In the recent elections, although there are no political parties allowed to operate in the tribal agencies, those who won were by and large known to be personally affiliated with the ANP or even the People's Party in one area, which is predominantly Shia. So it's clear that while the militants have been able to exercise power in those areas because there is no countervailing power of the state or other political organizations, the people have not given them their ideological allegiance, and in fact they have been complaining that they have been left to the domination of these groups, including foreigners, and they seem to very much support the idea of integrating the tribal agencies with the rest of Pakistan. Now, someone like Baitullah Massoud, also bear in mind, he is the Taliban leader, but the basis of his power is tribal. He is not a mullah or a clergyman. And he leads a section of the Massoud tribe. And you can be sure that the basis of his support is not predominantly an ideological one based, on a particular ideology. It has to do with the local tribal situation, their grievances against the government, against military interference. And even though it seems from our outside point of view that, pro-Taliban people could not also be, in favor of this very pro-Western, pro-democratic party now, the ANP, you'll find that they – at the popular level, there is some overlap in their real concerns, which are not necessarily what we interpret them to be. So there is a potential for co-opting a lot of those people.
Brian, do you want to add anything?
No, I mean, just in terms of U.S. policy, I'm afraid that it's still largely on autopilot, though I would say that we have a very capable ambassador on the ground, Ann Patterson, who I think has been trying to expand the range of contacts that we have within the Pakistani political spectrum. She's been doing this in ways that are often criticized, and I think you have to be careful in an environment like Pakistan because there's understandable concerns about the role of the U.S. But I think that the U.S. policy has a great opportunity here for change. I don't know that we'll seize it because a lot of the change and the decisions have to come from the very top, and it's a top here in Washington that I think is very distracted still by Iraq.
Next question, please.
Last question.
Once again, if you do have a question, please press the star and one. And we'll now go on to Meredith Buell of the Voice of America. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Let me ask both gentlemen. Head of the Central Intelligence Agency said last month that al-Qaeda has established a safe haven in these border areas and that presents a clear and present danger to both the region and the United States. If a ceasefire is declared and negotiations are undertaken, as appears to have been the case, what happens to the foreign fighters, the worst of the al-Qaeda and Taliban-linked people who are there, and what about any agreement that would be reached would keep these safe havens from getting either larger or more dangerous?
Well, I think the first thing to bear in mind is that the people who are engaging in this negotiation on the government side are people who have a very long and consistent track record of being fully opposed to the Taliban and al-Qaeda, which is something you cannot say for the Pakistan military. So they are much more credible when they say that they are not doing this to protect them. They are people who have themselves over many years been subject to assassination and attempts by these groups. Now, thus far, from what little I've seen, one of the subjects that is up for discussion in the negotiations is, again, the status of the foreign militants. And the government is demanding that, or asking, as part of the negotiations, that the local tribal fighters stop their protection of the foreigners. I don't know exactly what they're asking them to do with them at this point, but I'm sure that is on the agenda. It's not something that is going to happen in one day or one week, but there is a complete convergence of political interest between the United States and the parties that won the election in Pakistan as to what should happen to those extremist groups. But they differ about the means and about how to deal with some of the local Pakistan groups.
Brian?
Yeah, I largely agree with that assessment. I mean, that's a lot of what I heard while I was in Pakistan and was along those lines, that we've had enough of these foreign fighters and these attacks inside our country, and let us take the lead. And I think doing so requires a leap of faith, and that the U.S. Policymakers need to watch very carefully who is released, if there are prisoner releases, what is happening, but try not to interject so much in a process that could actually extend governance to some of these ungoverned territories.
Barney and Brian, thank you all both very much for this, I think, very informative discussion. If any of you from the press have any follow-on questions, you can call Adam Blickstein here at the National Security Network at 202-289-7113 or contact him online at ablickstein@nsnetwork.org. We will also have an MP3 audio, which will be available on our blog, Democracy Arsenal, later this afternoon. And again, on behalf of the National Security Network, thank you all very much for participating.